We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovics. Joining me today again is David Hunter, or better known as Dave H. Contrarian on Twitter. He's a contrarian macro strategist with 47 years experience. He also writes a quarterly letter by subscription. David, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're coming up on almost a year since you and I first spoke. Hard to believe. So looking back over that time period, we've seen Biden take office, interest rates rise, the S&P and Dow make new highs, and also the dollar starting to grind lower. Has there been anything that has taken you by surprise over this last year?
Well, certainly the last year itself was a surprise when it first happened. I mean, the pandemic and all that's happened since last March has certainly been beyond anything we've seen in our lifetimes, I think. So that's been surprising. In terms of the markets, not so much. I was probably seen as kind of crazy when I talked about significant new highs in the market last March when the market was at 2,200, and here we are, 4,200 plus. So that not so much. I would say the length of time it's taken gold to reemerge from its consolidation. I had a great run, last March through early August. And I thought maybe you'd get a few month consolidation and then pick up before the end of the year. And it's certainly been a much longer consolidation. I don't see it as anything other than that. As I like to say, markets don't do what we always want. Markets have their own timing. So sometimes they do things on schedule and sometimes they take longer. It doesn't cause me any concern in terms of it not coming around at some point. It's just really been, a longer consolidation. I think part of that has been the, last several months rise in interest rates. Mm-hmm.
So as I know, you say that we're headed for a spectacular melt up into the second quarter of this year. And that rally is being led by the semiconductor and FANG stocks. So is this due in part to all the currency that's been injected into the system?
For sure. It's definitely, all the liquidity, both, from the central banks and in our case, the Fed, and certainly the fiscal stimulus as well. That's all gone into it. It's also, keep in mind, we had such a horrific hit last March, and all through this, what's kept my conviction high is all through this climb in the last year, spectacular as it's been, investors have remained relatively restrained. There's been skepticism all the way up. There's been a real wall of worry to climb. Now, you're starting to see that lift up more. You do have, more signs that people are believers as the economy is recovering. But there's still a healthy amount of skepticism. Every time we get a few day pullback, people come out of the woodwork saying, okay, there's a big correction coming. Yeah, not so much. There's still plenty of bears out there, but it's not so much that as people calling for bigger corrections than I think we're going to get. I think the market's been self-correcting all the way up. And every call for a bigger correction has been, it's been far short of what they expected. So I think that's a sign that people have one leg out the door. Everybody's looking for a top. I think at the true top, you're going to have many, many more true believers saying, oh, this is, a cycle. It's just getting started. So, even though I think we're not very far away time-wise, you get another 500 point move in the S&P, and psychology can be very different than it is right now.
So what markets will all be kind of converging and making new highs in this scenario, David?
I'm still looking for, obviously, the equity markets to make new highs, commodity markets to make new highs. I think oil is right now in the process of a correction that's not done. But that will come out of that correction and probably make new cycle highs here. I mean, since last March. So you could see $75 on the oil by this summer. Gold and silver, certainly new highs, and significant new highs, I think, in both cases. Not new all-time highs in silver, but certainly gold. Bonds, not at all. Bonds, I think, can rally here, but I think in the course of this next few months, bonds are going to see rates backing up again after this run. Down the road, in what I'm pretty well known for my global bust call, in that bust, yes, I think bonds will make new highs there, or at least treasury bonds.
So as you were talking about the psychology of having one foot out the door, David, you've been making the prediction that we're going to see an 80% correction in the stock market. Is there a particular event that will be a catalyst for this by chance?
Sure. And I would say, 80 is the potential. Mm-hmm. It might be 65 or 70%, but I think the potential is there for an 80% bear market, which would make it the biggest bear market in the post-World War II era. And it basically comes down to a combination of the massive leverage in the system, the pandemic, the fragility in the system as a result of the pandemic and the leverage. And I think we're kind of converging on a period of time where the Fed can get caught between a rock and a hard place. They want to talk about transitory inflation, but everything I see in my work says inflation is going to get a lot hotter here in the next 6 months. And I think the Fed's going to have a hard time ignoring it. So, if they even, I like to point out that last July, we were barely a quarter or barely a few months removed from the swoon, from a second quarter disaster. And yet they felt comfortable enough pulling several hundred billion dollars off the balance sheet. They pulled money out of the system. And I think you could see that, certainly if you have, and at that time we had no inflation, and certainly if you have inflation picking up even more here, they could easily pull a half a billion, maybe $1 trillion out of the system. I don't think people realize how fragile this system is. It needs more new liquidity just to keep it going. And I also think that fragility, that leverage, is going to surprise people in terms of the extent to which it can speed up any kind of a, sell-off and make it a lot, exacerbate it.
I'd like to explore that a little bit more, David. Why is it, let's say, that this leverage is such a, or can speed up this process so much? And talk to us a little bit about how big this derivatives market really is.
Yeah, I talk about leverage being both debt and derivatives. And I think we talk about leverage typically in terms of debt. So you hear people throwing around the tremendous debt that we all know is in the system. But the derivatives is a phenomenon that really, from the late 80s on started growing. And it's so much bigger today than it was in the 2008-09 decline. So the fact that you've got a much more, a far bigger percentage of the markets involved in derivatives means it's the tail wagging the door, the dog. The derivatives can really speed up things, and obviously markets are tied to the derivatives, so when things start unwinding, it pushes the market. So I just think it's kind of, from a simplistic standpoint, we know leverage is one of the reasons we've seen this bubble blow up. And it's going to be just as much responsible for why the thing can deflate very quickly.
So, David, could you explain to us your view on the inflation deflation cycle over the coming years, and kind of give us a timeline and a 5,000 foot look at how you see this cycle with inflation and deflation developing?
Sure. It's important to remember that we haven't had a widespread deflationary downturn since the 1930s, since the Great Depression. So really in the entire post-World War II era, we've had, you know, inflation and disinflation, but not deflation. And I think people throw terms around and I think they get confused. I even hear economists sometimes throw, you know, they mean say disinflation and they say deflation. You know, disinflation, as you know, is inflation coming at a ever lower rate. So, you know, we had inflation at 15% and 20% in the early 80s, and it's ratcheted down over the last 40 years from there to where we got down very close to zero, and now we're reversing that to some extent. And I think we are so late in the cycle. And I do think, you know, the global bust is what the end of the cycle is. We are so late in this cycle that started in 2009 that with inflation, you know, a year ago at close to zero and picking up here so that it could be 3 to 4%, I think, this year. But still relatively low this late in the cycle. If they have to tighten because of the overheating of the economy, you can easily tip into negative territory if, you know, if through a policy mistake and the combination of that and the pandemic after effects, you end up with a pretty deep downturn. We're just, you know, we're not having a downturn start with inflation at 7 or 8%. We're having a downturn start with it very low. And really a lot of the inflation is commodity inflation. So that can reverse in a hurry when demand drops. So that tells you that you're pretty close to a point where it's funny because you've got so many people worried about inflation this year, including myself, and what the Fed's going to have to do to deal with that. But at the same time, I think you're very close to, on a, you know, longer, bigger picture, bigger cycles perspective, from longer perspective, you're very close to deflation. So having the Fed deal with what they think is a breakout in inflation on the eve of what I think is we're set up for because of leverage deflation makes a very complex situation for any central bank to handle. And I'm not sure they understand how fast we could slip into deflation if policy mistakes are made. So I just think we're in a very unusual time where normally these things play out over years, and where just a small misstep can take you from worrying about inflation to saying, oh my God, we haven't been here before. You know, we haven't seen this in our lifetimes. There's not any real precedent for this, certainly in the post-World War II era. And as we all know, central bankers rely a lot on precedent. I mean, they're flying blind in a lot of this. So anyway, I think we could see before this year's out that downturn begin, and that downturn slip into deflation very quickly. As I say, you know, the Great Depression was a long, drawn out downturn where deflation was there for several years. This deflation is probably going to be contained within a year, and the downturn is probably going to be contained within something like that. That's why I use the term bust. It's really not a depression because it's not going to be long and drawn out, but it's going to have some of the characteristics of a depression, some of the damage of a depression in terms of the size of the banking crisis, the size of the involuntary debt liquidation because of the massive leverage. And again, you know, we're speaking about the U.S., but it's really a global story. So, and I think in some respects, Europe's in much more precarious position than we are financially. So I think this thing's going to trip across the globe. And I think we have the potential here. We'll see, but I think we have the potential here for this to be the largest financial crisis in the history of the world. So not the largest downturn in the economy, but the largest financial crisis because of the massive leverage in the system, because the banks are, you know, there's so much risk across the spectrum. So I just think between the fourth quarter of this year and the middle of next year could be, maybe the roughest time in my, I've been in this 48 years and maybe the roughest period we've seen. Mm-hmm.
So David, is it possible that we can kind of parse this out? You're saying that we're going to see inflation and deflation, but if we look at different sectors of the economy, could we see deflation and inflation happening simultaneously?
I don't think so. Anything's possible, and because it's going to be very quick, and certainly they're going to come back the other way with all kinds of liquidity, it's hard to know whether, everything's going to deflate. It's going to be not like the deflation of the 30s where, it just played out year after year so that everything just kept getting more gloomy. This will be fast enough. It's possible. I would say, for example, you may be thinking of real estate. We have no inventory in real estate, and it'd be easy to make the case that, you could have real estate soften a little bit, but you're not going to get any big decline in real estate because this isn't going to be down long enough, or because they're going to be pumping liquidity up fast, soon enough. That's possible, but more likely this thing unwinds so dramatically. I just tell people go back and look at last March and how fast we went into the second quarter swoon. I mean, it was scary. I mean, we didn't know where we were, and I realized it was forced shutdown, so that was part of it. But that should tell people, both from a market perspective and an economic perspective, that things can go from seemingly pretty good to very bad in a hurry because of that leverage, because of the way the system is set up. So my primary forecast would say most things are going to deflate. Most assets anyway, certainly. But is it going to be long and drawn out? No, and the other thing is, don't forget there's a lag to when the money is created to when it, turns things again. So even if they were quick to turn the spigots back on, you're still talking, probably 9 months before it really impacts the economy, and maybe another year and a half before it impacts, inflation in a big way. So I do think, I think there's a tendency out there, particularly in the retail public, to think in these linear terms where everything happens, bing, bang, boom. And so, how can you have a bear market if the Fed knows they have to print money? Since they've already learned this lesson, how are you going to have a bear market? And I don't think people realize, pauses in this kind of a leverage situation can be eternities. If you have a few months where they're not sure what to do because they're facing inflation, that few months of misstep can feel like an eternity.
So if the Fed starts to really try and combat this inflation, are we going to see some type of yield curve control and that ultimately leads to the bust?
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm not in the camp where I will say for sure yield curve control on a longer term basis is a myth. There's no such thing because inflation is going to force their hand. Mm-hmm. In the short run, sure, they can try. I don't think yield controls are the issue because rates are going to be dropping because of the bust. And then coming out the other way, rates aren't going to be the issue. You're probably, let's say the bust starts late this year and carry through at least first half of next year, maybe all next year. You're probably looking at 2024 before you really have another inflation concern like we have right now, where you're pushing above 4% and people are starting to say, hey, this thing's getting going. It's going to take a while coming out of deflation to just get back above zero, at least several months and maybe a year. And then you're going to be in very low single digits for a little while because I think we can use last year is a microcosm or some kind of a, you know, can get some understanding of what it will look like on the other side of the bust. And so, you know, the real inflation story, I think, is out in 2024, but really 2025-6 is when I think you're starting to push high single digits into double digit inflation. And that's when, you know, you can talk about yield curve controls at that time. Having lived through the Volcker era, you know, and the G. William Miller era prior to that, that got us there, you know, thinking you can control interest rates, the only way you control interest rates is by pouring more fuel on the fire. By pouring more fuel on the fire, you're going to have even a bigger inflation problem. That's exactly what got us in trouble. Was G. William Miller thought he was tightening because rates were going up gradually, but he was having to pour money and to keep rates from going up faster. You know, he was trying to manipulate the market, and I'm not sure he saw it that way, but that led to inflation getting more fuel. And, you know, it's a monetary event ultimately, and you get an overheated situation. And once you get above a certain liftoff point, it really becomes very, very difficult to control the inflation. It takes a real, much bigger tightening.
You were mentioning the speed at which the interest rates are going up. So why does this matter so much to the Fed?
Well, interest rates obviously impact economic activity, particularly in housing, and auto purchase, et cetera. Some big parts of our economy are very much interest rate sensitive, more so today than ever. I mean, these low rates, you move them 1%, and it can shut down refinancing, it can shut down home buying, et cetera. So people are really dependent on very low rates. So they do worry about that. I have to say, I'm much more of a monetarist, where I think money is what matters most, and that the price of money will ultimately follow, you know, the market will determine that. But in the shorter run, you know, certainly the Fed feels the control over the economy is really, you know, rate control.
So in that vein, David, where do you see the dollar going from here? Is it going to continue to kind of grind lower at this pace, or how do you see this dollar scenario developing?
I think last time we talked, I had an 85 target on the dollar, got down to, I think, 89, and then it's, you know, spent most of this year going back from there back to, you know, 90, 93 or almost 94. I think we've rolled over again. I've actually lowered my target, which had been 85 for quite some time. I think there's a, you know, 85 is a minimum, but I think there's a pretty good chance we could go down to 82. And so I think we've started that move back down. I know there's still a lot of people out there talking stronger dollar and thinking that, you know, it can get up into the mid 90s. I don't think so. I think we've broken back down, or, you know, we've finished the consolidation, the upward consolidation. And part of my call is based on what I see in the other currencies. You know, the euro looks like against dollar looks like can get up to up to 130. I think Canadian dollar, I've raised my target. I had an 80, you know, 0.85 target. It looks like can get up to 0.90. The Aussie dollar can get up to maybe 0.85 and maybe even higher than that. So I'm looking at, you know, other moves in other currencies, and it tells me the dollar is going to be weaker than I even expected. So that will help fuel the inflation, help fuel the commodity run here. And I think that move is between now and Labor Day. I mean, and maybe sooner. You know, it's starting now, and it's not going to be slow. It's not going to be, you know, there'll be days where you get the counter moves and or flatness. But ultimately, I think the move from here down to 85 and maybe 82 happens in a matter of months.
So as I know that timelines are really hard to pin down, David, do you still kind of have that end of second quarter timeline for this bust to start?
Well, not the bust. I have said for quite some time, certainly coming into this year, that the bust is a second half event probably a latter part of the year event. So, you know, I don't expect the bust certainly to start in second quarter. I have to kind of make clear, the bear market refers to the market, obviously, to the equity market. The bust refers to the economy. The stock market typically leads the economy by several months. So if we get a top in the stock market this quarter, and I'm still saying I think that's likely, a top doesn't mean, you know, you hit a top and then you're on your way down the next day. So that top could reverse quickly. Oftentimes, though, as you will know, it reverses and then has a secondary rally back up and retest that high. Maybe doesn't go all the way back up. So you could be, you know, midway through the third quarter where you really, before you really start seeing the market unwind, or it could unwind quickly. I have no way of knowing. But, you know, if the window of the top is, let's say, end of May to, you know, early July, and that top then stretches out into, you know, much of the third quarter, you know, your bust may not start until late this year. If the top is May and we reverse pretty quickly, you know, bust is probably more likely a late third quarter or early fourth quarter event. So, you know, I still think the bust starts this year, but I don't know whether it's, you know, starts in September or December, you know, type of thing. And that's the economy. We'll feel like we're there because the bear market will be, you know, on its way before that. So I'm really just talking about what will the economic statistics show was the actual peak in the economy. And it might be, you know, might be third quarter.
So as the, let's say the market correction proceeds, what happens to the metals and miners in that scenario, David?
Yeah, my guess is that they definitely correct, as with most assets in the bear market or in the bust, but probably far less than the equity markets do. Partly because I think the Fed will be coming back in with both feet, you know, meaning easing aggressively, you know, once they start seeing this thing unwind pretty fast. So I think the timing on gold and silver going back the other way, back up, will come before the stock market, because I think people will be more attuned to, hey, when the Fed's really aggressively easing, we want to get into those precious metals. But I'm guessing probably you could have a 30% pullback in the metals, maybe a little more in silver. So if, you know, my forecast on gold is 2,500 for, you know, the next several months, probably a third quarter top. And if you get a 30% move from there, you know, you're basically back here. Silver, you know, I think you can get to 4550. Let's say it's a 40% move back, or 35-40% move back. You're talking about something back here, you know. So it's not like there's a lot of downside from here. I know there's still a lot of people that are talking lower numbers on both gold and silver, but I tend to think we're, you know, you may come back and retest this during the bust, but I don't think you're going a lot lower than these levels. Now, you know, a couple of years ago, I was in the camp that said, you know, gold could see, you know, 500 or 800 in the bust, but I'm not there anymore. I just don't think it's possible it could get down towards 1,000. But I doubt it. I think this time spent, this last many, many months spent in that 1,700-1,800 area may serve as the floor.
So typically we hear that real rates are closely related to the gold price. So why have they become disconnected over the past couple months?
Yeah, it's funny because I think people, you know, we use the CPI, or a lot of people use CPI as a measure of inflation when they're talking about real rates, and they've been talking about real rates rising. But in fact, if you were more, you know, just looking at what inflation's done in this, you know, first part of this year, there's no doubt when you look at a lot of the, you know, across the board commodity complex, or, you know, in costs in other areas, you know, auto costs, housing costs, et cetera, it's very hard to argue that CPI is an accurate measure of inflation right now, right? I mean, we are, you know, for years people have said the government's manipulating that number, but I'm not necessarily in that camp as much as just saying, you know, if you really want realistic inflation, you can't be looking and saying it's 1.5 or 2%. It's certainly in the last many months has gone much higher than that. So I think, you know, whether it's the algos or whoever's judging real rates, I think they're using an artificial number as your denominator to argue that it, you know, real rates are rising along with nominal rates. I think nominal rates obviously have risen, and I was probably the first one out there to when the 10-year was 0.6, I was talking about it going to 120 to 140, and then I raised it to 150. And so the rate rise didn't surprise me, but the call that the real rates are still rising, I think is just false. I think real rates, but that's what the market believed, or that's what the algo believed. So I think they did that. Now, you know, going forward, I don't see how anybody can believe real rates are rising unless nominal go up a lot. And I think so, even though I'm calling for a 120 10-year this quarter, in the next month or two. And so if the nominal goes to 120, clearly real rates are dropping and dropping fairly fast. And then I'm calling for a 2.5 10-year as the Fed begins to tighten and as inflation begins to take off. But even there, I think inflation is going to be outpacing that rise from 120 to 2.5. So it's hard for me to see a scenario between now and Labor Day where you make the case that real rates are rising. I think they'll be falling even if nominal rates are going up.
David, as we take a step back to look at the financial landscape at this time, what, in your view, are some of the biggest bubbles that will suffer in this bust, as you have coined it? Are we going to see, let's say, house prices really, really come down? Crypto, where do you see the biggest declines or the biggest bubbles that are going to pop?
Yeah, I would say certainly the equity market. I mean, I think it's been a remarkable run. As I've said for a long time, I believe we're coming on a secular peak that started back in 1982. And I could even make the case it started in 1974. So it's been an amazing run. But there are so many signs that we're in that. And I started talking about this several years ago. We're in that final parabolic stage. So not many markets are in parabolics like equities are. And parabolic just tells you, I think you're in a very speculative stage. That's the end stage of a long-term market. That tells me that equities are the, you know, probably the prime asset that's going to get hit hard. Junk bonds also. And you know, to a lesser extent, certainly some of these other assets like, you know, real estate. Real estate's a funny one because I do think we may be making a secular top here. And in fact, probably likely are. But I just don't know how fast and how hard things are going to fall. You know, I think in the States anyway, you know, we got hit so hard in 2008-09. Is this going to be a lot like that one? We don't have the subprime issues this time, but we have other issues. Canada and Australia are some of the, you know, those kind of markets, I think, they're where we were in 2008-09. So, yeah, I think those are going to be huge bubbles that break big. And I think the U.S. housing is going to get hit hard. I just don't know if it's going to be 2008-09 hard. I doubt that.
So as you use the term super cycle, David, does this apply to your view on commodities in general for the coming years?
For sure. You know, we're in a super cycle, and I define a super cycle as between two depressions. So if the 1930s was your last depression, I believe the 2030s are likely to be the next depression. So that's why I say this is a bust, not a depression. So we still have one more recovery cycle after this bust to get us to the what I would think will be the end of the super cycle. And so by the end of the super cycle, for sure, commodities, I think, are in for a huge run in the post-bust era. It's not a straight line, as I like to caution people. You know, the move in commodities this year has been a great run, and you got a lot of analysts out there calling for a super cycle in commodities from here. That bust is going to interrupt the commodity cycle. And so just be careful, as I use the analogy. You know, it's like standing on the south rim of the Grand Canyon, looking across the north rim and thinking it's a straight line across when there's this huge canyon in between. So, you know, thinking you can buy commodities today and that there'll be no, you know, just own them right on through. You've got that bust is going to be a big canyon for commodities. And so, but starting in say 20, you know, latter part of 2022 through the end of the decade, commodities are going to have a run like they've never had in history. You know, oil can get to $300 plus, you know, gold can get to $10,000 plus, silver can get to $300 plus. And I think those pluses may make my numbers look silly, you know, silly low when we get there. So I think it's, you know, I just can't see anything beyond those numbers to give a number, but I think commodities can have unbelievable runs. Copper, you know, copper could go up tenfold or, you know, seven or eightfold, you know. So there's, I think there's big moves coming in the next cycle because of the massive money that the whole, you know, the whole world's going to be putting out there to deal with the financial crisis. But yes, it's a super cycle. Like I said, equities, in my opinion, again, talking about U.S. equities, but probably to a great extent other places too. You know, you're going to make a secular top here, meaning that the recovery cycle in equities after the bust, you won't come close to these highs. The highs we see, whether it's this quarter or next, I doubt that we come close to those. So if it's 4,700 on the S&P, or maybe it's 5,000 when you get in a parabolic, I'm not, you know, I'm not pretending to know exactly where it stops, but it's, it, we're in the area somewhere 4,700 to 5,000, probably a pretty good guess about the top. Next cycle, you could, if you have an 80% drop and you get back to 1,000, you could triple the S&P out of that bottom, or even quadruple it, and you're still falling far short of the top. So it's not to say that equities won't have a run next cycle, but I think you're making a secular top that's probably going to stand for decades. And I don't know whether that's two decades or many more decades than that, but decades. Whereas gold and silver and other commodities, next cycle, they go on to much, much, much higher highs. So it's, you know, there'll be a great opportunity following the bust. It's just not going to be in the same areas, not the same assets, not the same sectors of the stock market. You know, social media stocks and the FANGs and you know, growth stocks in general, they're going to be dealing with a tremendous headwind of inflation, meaning inflation and high interest rates, as rates move from, let's say, I'll just use a 10-year from zero at the top of the bond market in the bust, you could see the 10-year back to 15% by the end of the decade. And buying index funds, how do you think that rise from zero to 15 in rates is going to impact PE multiples? It's an inverse relationship. It's going to impact them pretty negatively. So it's going to be very hard for indexes to do well next cycle overall, but that doesn't rule out the sectors that really benefit from inflation.
So as a macro voice, David, you actually speak quite a bit about oil. And I wanted to ask, how important is the oil price in today's economy? And do you use it as a particular tool, let's say in your toolkit to analyze other markets as well?
I look at it, certainly. It's not a primary driver. I mean, because we've had, you know, oil and gas prices under control here. So it's been a benefit to consumers in general. Obviously, of late, gas prices have moved up and, you know, oil's moving up, but really, I think longer term, It's a big factor in the next cycle. I mean, that's why I think the next cycle is going to be an industrially led cycle. The consumer is going to be, on the one hand, digging out from a horrendous bust. That's, you know, they're not strong going into it. You know, financially, we've had decades of, you know, people really struggling. And we all know the story about the haves and the have-nots. There's a big part of the world economy that's a have-not. And so they're going to be struggling. And then you add on to that, you know, if oil prices go to $300 plus a barrel, you know, what's that do to gasoline prices? They're going to be easily double-digit. What's that do to, you know, heating oil prices, et cetera. So I think the consumer is going to have, you know, a real problem. Even if wages finally begin to break out, they're not going to be able to keep pace. They're going to be following inflation, not leading it by any means, especially in the kind of fast commodity cycle we're going to see. So, yeah, I mean, oil is in a bigger picture way, something I look at all the time in terms of how is that going to impact my longer forecast. In terms of, you know, my last year's forecast, it wasn't a big driver.
We've spoken about, you know, looking at something like a banking crisis going into this, David. And I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, there's a lot of analysts out there talking about currency resets and new digital currencies or a world currency. How do you see that developing?
Yeah, I'm not big on the reset. I think if we're going to have a reset, I think it's late in the decade. You know, I don't believe we're, you know, I know there's concerns about what China's doing with crypto, et cetera. Now, I just don't see anything poised to be able to take over the dollar's role as a reserve currency in the next 5 years. You go out beyond that and it's anybody's guess. I do think the dollar is going to be in trouble within that 5 year time horizon. You know, we talked about my view that the dollar is going to the low 80s here. I also think the dollar is going to be 120 plus in the bust, that it will be the currency everybody runs to during the bust because they don't know where else to run and don't have anywhere else to run. But then starting from that, wherever that high is, over 120, I think the dollar begins a long-term erosion through then to the end of the decade where it could be, you know, less than 50 cents. I mean, it could be a lot, you know, a lot lower than 80. And so the dollar is not, you know, I'm not a bull on the dollar beyond the bust or, you know, that period. But it's not going to be replaced as a reserve currency, I don't think, until you get later in, you know, much later in the decade. I do believe that, you know, you talk about high inflation, you know, 15-20% inflation rates, interest rates at 15%, and short rates probably, you know, like they were in the early 80s, up around 20%. You know, those are all things that argue that, you know, the bust is going to seem not to be the big deal once, because that takes all the central banks out of the game. If you don't have, you know, that's why I've been such a bull. Even last March, I said, you know, the Fed's not out of bullets. They're not even close to out of bullets because in deflation or low inflation, they have unlimited ability to print. You get to the opposite situation where you have interest rates, you know, high and inflation high. As I said before, they can't pour fuel on the fire because it just exacerbates what they're trying to fix. So that takes them out of the game. The Treasury will be long out of the game because nobody's going to want to buy Treasury paper when we can't service that debt. So you get to the end of the decade and basically there's nothing to prop up things when they roll over. You know, there's no way the Fed can intervene. And so that's when you can get the collapse of the system, you know, what I call the, you know, the collapse of the Ponzi scheme that's built up over, you know, five decades. And not, you know, I speak of the U.S. mostly, but it's really a worldwide event. And what comes out of a collapse of the last 50 years is anybody's guess, but I don't think it's something that anybody should look forward to because it more likely is a totalitarian response. You know, it's more likely to be something. So I just, people want to talk about resets and stuff. That's your reset. And it's nothing you can predict or plan for. You know, it's just going to come. Yeah, there's, I mean, there's, you can design any currency you want. If you get that kind of a collapse, it doesn't matter.
I'd like to turn a little bit to talking about investor psychology with you, David. Why is it so hard for most investors to buy at bottoms, and why is it hard as well for some of them to take profits at these euphoric tops that we're going to see?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's, you know, I've spent 48 years as a contrarian studying that stuff, and I don't have any scientific answer for you. What I do have is I can tell you from being one of those that fought the crowd that the vast majority of people just are not comfortable being outside the crowd. You know, there's a lot of people today, you know, when I was a contrarian back in the early 70s, and, you know, it was a rare event. There weren't very many, and it wasn't something you trumpeted. It wasn't, you know, today everybody wants to tell you they're a contrarian because there have been books out there talking about, you know, how it's wise to be opposite to what the crowd is, et cetera. But we can go back in history to the tulip bulb craze, to, you know, all kinds of various times, and there have been books written on it, you know, the madness of crowds. It is just a psychological truth that the vast majority of people, whether they know it or not, are not comfortable being outside the crowd and are influenced by the crowd. You know, they can say, I'm a contrarian, but in the end, when push comes to shove, it's a very small percentage of people who feel comfortable with conviction being against that crowd. Most of the time, you know, they can do it in verbiage, but if you look at what their actions are, they're, you know, they're hedged every which way because they're not comfortable. So it's just a, you know, the crowd is going to be most excited at tops and least excited at bottoms. And so they're, and, you know, interestingly, and this probably only made it worse, is with the advent of computers and everybody being a technician today and everybody being a relative strength technician, it just follows it. They go with the momentum, you know?
So as you recently tweeted, perspective is important in investing, but often lacking among investors. The perception that the miners behave terribly, or the perception is that the miners behave terribly. Sentiment is very negative. So how do you look at this, David, and why is it, or how does it inform your decisions here?
Yeah, I guess probably the way I'd answer that is, to me, a lot of times people become too myopic. And so that's what I mean by perspective, is sometimes you have to step back, broaden out the chart, broaden out the time horizon. And, you know, for example, I mean, gold and silver are a great example. You know, everybody loved it back in early August. And, you know, were people who didn't like it a few months earlier were starting to really talk bullish. And like I said, even I thought, okay, you'll have a few months rest because it's gone too far. But, you know, when it didn't happen after a few months, people lose more and more faith because they say, well, I thought, you know, I thought it would have turned by now. And they lose all perspective if you step back. And here's a good example. Gold, this happened to me on Twitter. Gold, about the fourth week of March, the one-year anniversary was passed of the swoon, of the, you know, the big pandemic break. So I had people coming to me and saying, you know, gold hasn't gained anything in the last year. Yeah, but if you step back another week to the bottom, you know, gold had gone down to 1460. And when they were saying that, gold was, you know, 1700 or 1680. So, you know, perspective is that 1 year versus 1 year and 1 week gave you two different pictures. And they lose that perspective because they're only caught on the one-year chart, you know? So it's really important, I think, sometimes to kind of step back and see where you are. I've caught in a lot of grief in recent months because I go, I love the gold chart. I love the silver chart. You know, they are in flag formation. When they break out, they're going to break out vertically and they're going to go a long ways. And yet people only see the fact that, gee, gold was 2100 and now it's 1700, you know, back a few weeks ago. And, you know, it's lost a lot of money for me while everything else is going up. So, you know, again, timing is part of the story, but perspective and having a little bit broader perspective can make a big difference.
Are there any tools or processes that you use to guide your decision making on when to take profits in an investment, David?
Not really. It's really, you know, I don't want to say it's feel. Obviously, if I see it's, I'd say sentiment drives me more than anything. You know, if I see sentiment really to an extreme in either direction, that has probably as big an impact on me as anything else. But, you know, fundamentals matter to me. Macro matters to me. It's really putting the whole thing into a, you know, a mixer and saying, how does it shake out?
Excellent. So David, as we kind of wrap up here, can you give us some of your price targets, let's say towards the end of the second quarter here, before we really have to put our seatbelts on?
Sure. Yeah. I'll start with the stock market. And I do think S&P, my current target, I've raised it in the last month, but my current target's 4,700. And like I said, and I've said this several times on Twitter, I won't be surprised if my numbers are too conservative. So, well, people think I'm insane with these numbers. I think I'm probably going to be low. So S&P 4,700, Dow 38,000, NASDAQ 17,000. And then on the bonds, I think you can, like I said, you can get to an interest rate, you can get to a 120 here this quarter, and then start pushing back up to 2.5. The 30 year, I think, can get down to say 195 and then start pushing back to 3%. Gold 2,500 is my top. And again, I might push beyond that, but that's kind of my target. Silver 45 to 50, longer term beyond that, you know, as I said, those things have a lot of upside, but it's just not going to be a straight line. Oil probably can get down to the low 50s here. The jury's out right now, but my best guess, I mean, it's possible we've had our consolidation oil and it starts running again, but I think more likely it gets down to somewhere between 50 and 54 before it makes another run at 75. And then in the bust, I expect oil down to, you know, below $20, maybe $10 again, before it starts the big, you know, the big move coming out of the bust. Let's see, what have I missed?
GDX, GDXJ?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, and the miners themselves, GDX, I've raised my target. I've been saying 55. I think 60 is a better target. GDXJ, my target's 100. SIL, which is a silver ETF, probably 75. And SILJ, I had been using 30, and I think 35, and I think that's probably going to prove low. If silver goes to 45 or 50, I wouldn't be surprised to see if these numbers get exceeded. So we'll see, but I think we're very close. I think, you know, you're starting to see the downtrend being broken, the recent downtrend, and I do think that gold and silver are going to start acting better as we move through this quarter.
Excellent, David. Do you have anything else that you'd like to share with us before we wrap up?
Let's see. What haven't we touched on? You know, obviously, from a longer term standpoint, you know, the junk bond area is an area that's very frothy. You know, people, because of these low yields we've had, have really reached out on the risk curve to get income. And I would just caution people that, you know, not equities are probably number one, but I think junk bonds are right behind them in terms of the two areas that are going to get hit the hardest in terms of the bust. You know, they are, you know, the exact example of what leverage means. and if I'm right about oil, you know, if we get oil back from 75 down to 10, you know, as you well know, there's a lot of leverage in the shale oil area that kind of got bailed out in March, you know, in the second quarter of last year, that I think is going to have real problems, you know, in the bust and won't be bailed out.
Excellent, David. And as always, we can get more of your updates and you provide great analysis on your Twitter at Dave H. Contrarian. And also tell us about your quarterly newsletter that you put out.
Yeah, I read a quarterly letter that if people are interested, it's basically my macro in a bit broader perspective on Twitter. Obviously, you're limited by what you can put out there. So if people want more on my forecasts, they go out quarterly and people wonder why I don't write more often. I said, you know, I'm a big picture guy. You know, I think one of the things I push back on is trying to get people to be not so trader oriented and be, like I said, that broader perspective, bigger picture perspective. So I purposely don't put things out more than quarterly. So I have a quarterly letter. If people have any interest in that, they can inquire by DM, you know, just direct message me on Twitter. And again, my handle there is at Dave H. Contrarian.
Excellent, David. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Okay, Tom. Yeah, I think we're going to have some fun this quarter.
Absolutely. It'll be really interesting to see what happens.
Okay, thank you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.